Iku Iluna, please rise. Auhea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imua okea aha ho o kolo kolo ki eke hanohano o komako aina o Hawaii. E nawe mai, e malio mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Delina, makamoko puni o Oahu I kamoko o kona eia no kako ma ali o lanihale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at Ali'i Olanihale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-23-0000359. State of Hawaii, respondent plaintiff appellee versus Ashley Vincent Gaeta, petitioner defendant appellant. Arguing for the petitioner, Ashley Vincent Gaeta, Jason R. Quiet. Arguing for the respondent, State of Hawaii, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Frederick M. Makapinla. Argument on the merits.
Aloha, kakahiaka, good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Karen Homa. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. And just to confirm, Mr. Quiet, I understand you'll argue for 20 minutes, reserve any remaining time for rebuttal. And Mr. Makapintak, you will have 30 minutes with a 2-minute warning. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Quiet, please proceed.
Madam Acting Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Jason Quiet. I am honored.
I'm sorry to have mispronounced your name.
Oh, no. It's spelled K-W-I-A-T, spelled Q-U-I-E. It's my honor to represent Vince Gaeta in this matter. I represented him throughout the entire case. And where we're at in the proceedings now, this case tests the limits that this court recognized in State v. Sotoa Faiga, and whether or not the rule announced in that case has real force. The trial court in this case explicitly said it's not considering penetration, and there was a back and forth of sorts about how it wasn't considering penetration. But the denial of the deferral relied on harm described by the complaining witness, which was harm that only existed from a rape. She discussed STDs, which there was nothing in the record about. She discussed that he was a predator, that he would do it again. Nothing in the record to indicate that. And, she talked about how she submitted to SANE exams and so on, and that all stems from a rape. Whereas the charge was amended per the plea from two sex assault twos and an attempted sex assault by compulsion to a what's traditionally known as the flashing of an individual. And so it was an amended charge. And so that's the major argument we made, that whenever Sotoa Faiga requires that conduct logically excluded should not be considered at sentencing, but when the harm from those dismissed charges is considered as sentencing, is there a due process?
Right, but the court said that it was expressly not going to consider remorse, penetration. So even though the CW may have made statements related to what you described as rape, I thought the judge was pretty clear in saying he wasn't going to consider that.
Why shouldn't we
believe the judge in terms of that's what happened?
I don't think that it's that you shouldn't believe the judge. I do think that when the judge is saying he wasn't considering the penetration for purposes of the actual sentence, yes, but he did consider the victim impact statement, he specifically said, I'm not considering penetration, but I'm considering the impact on the victim. And then the victim spoke.
Well, if you're going to exclude the penetration, then he's excluding the impact of the penetration as well, or the alleged penetration. Isn't that
yes,
what the judge seemed to be saying? And he seemed to be responding to you directly when you raised those concerns.
Yes.
Yeah. So he was very clear, and he was actually saying, for the record, purposes of appeal, make it clear that remorse and penetration are out.
Right.
Why is that abuse?
Well, the point that I'm making is really subtle, and it's just that in the deferral context, they were the factors that he needed to analyze under there. Yes, he wasn't considering penetration, which I believe is correct. I don't think he was considering penetration. What he considered was the impact of the harm. And when the complaining witness came in and, you know, got in all that stuff that the prosecutor didn't, which was the same exam, allegations of rape, STD, so on and so forth, then you're necessarily relying on that impact statement and making the decision to deny a deferral. And that impact statement, you know, went beyond the...
Well, I mean, what's a court supposed to do? I mean, there's PSIs. The victims will constantly, and they have the right. They will get up in court, just as a defendant has a right to allocution. There's a victim's right to get up in court. And the victim may stray away from the actual pled offense. And is the court supposed to just plug its ears and not listen to that?
Well, yeah. I think that the court can listen to a victim. They have a right to say their piece. But as far as victim rights are concerned, they can't get in inadmissible evidence. It's due process violation for a victim to get up and talk about how they were raped and forcibly penetrated when it's a flashing case, essentially flashing directed towards an individual, not like a public flashing.
But yeah, a complaining witness can say all sorts of things, but the judge has to sort through that. And I thought the judge was crystal clear in saying, I'm not going to consider those extraneous statements that in his mind wasn't relevant. And it was all in response to your objections or your concerns that were raised. Where's the abuse in that?
Our position is that the abuse is when you consider the statement and consider the impact that she's saying, that is an impact from a rape, not from a...
I understand, and he can exclude that from his consideration.
Yeah.
Which seems to be reflected in the record.
He
was very mindful of the record and what may come
up. He was. No doubt about it. I'm not challenging him.
You are challenging it.
Well, I'm challenging it to the extent that he didn't get the proper analysis under the deferral statute. I'm not saying that it was unfair. I'm not saying that it was a bad sentence. I'm just saying we just wanted a fair shake of the deferral analysis, which has the three factors that he's not likely to commit it again. This was a one-time situational thing. There was no evidence like in Sotoa Figa that, where there were 16,000 text messages, which – sort of smacked of a grooming thing. This was a one night. She invited him out to go out with.
Okay, but you're not taking the position that the court can't consider the impact on the victim at all.
No. I'm not taking that position. Not at all. No, they have a right to make an impact statement. I think that it should be tailored, and it should be the prosecutor should work with the victim. Like we were surprised here that the victim came in and was so upset with the plea offer. I knew that she was going to be upset, obviously.
But all kinds of things happen in the battle, and you raised the objections, and the court noted it, and the court responded. So I still need you to point out where the abuse occurred, because when the court says, I'm not going to consider these things in direct response to your objections, why shouldn't we believe that's exactly what the judge did in this case?
Well, our position is that what else would he have ruled upon if it was for the impact, which is directly what he said, I'm going on the impact on the victim, and the victim is talking about rape, then the decision flows from that impact statement and a rape, which he was not convicted of.
Did she say anything about the harm that had been caused to her by being exposed to his penis?
Not specifically, but at the sentencing she did. She never testified in an evidentiary hearing. But at sentencing...
I meant at the sentencing hearing, not evidentiary.
Yeah, she wasn't specific as to...
At the time of the decision, the court said, you look at her, you know I'm looking at her, and she is devastated by what happened, the incident. You're only pleading to 6-4, I get that, but I have to take into consideration the nature of the harm, right? In the normal case, and it's like an eggshell skull, which is referring to her prior allegation of sexual assault, her prior sexual assault, apparently, that she had gone through?
I believe so, as well as, you know, when you take somebody as you find them, is the point that I think he was making.
Okay.
But yes, she did make statements. She didn't specifically talk about the sex assault four because it was, frankly, that was fashioned, you know, to get to the plea. You know, it was there would have been facts on each. It's a he said, she said case, and we resolved it on the sex assault four. So to my recollection, and Mr. Maka Penlock may have something to the alternative, but I don't recall her specifically saying anything about being offended by him exposing his penis, because the facts are they were sleeping in the same bed together, they were kissing, making out, and...
But she did talk about having to recite what happened and...
Oh, yes.
And that
She absolutely talked about the impact it had on her and the negative impact it had on her. She definitely did. And that was appropriate. A victim can do that.
Which may very well have been related to the exposure.
It could have been. I just don't know. She didn't specifically note the exposure. She couched her statement in terms of rape.
But wouldn't the impact on the victim also be, this is late at night, this is a trusted person that did something to me, sex four perhaps, I'm vulnerable. I mean, the court didn't specifically tether it to penetration. The court could have, prosecution could make the point that the court was simply saying the impact on the victim through the actual offense itself.
It's possible that, yeah, that they're saying that. That's the position that we're taking is, with Sotoa Faiga, if conduct is logically excluded, it shouldn't be considered. So in Sotoa Faiga, there was, the sex assault, I believe it was a sex assault four, but it was a contact in that case. And, the deferral... Well, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought with respect to Sotoa Faiga, but conduct logically excluded by the plea cannot be considered. But then it says, but circumstances of the offense can be for general sentencing purposes. And the concern there is that the exception, that it can be generally considered for the circumstances of the greater offense will swallow the rule that Sotoa Faiga set, which is conduct logically excluded cannot be considered at sentencing.
Mr. Quiet, what is confusing to me in this case is the plea agreement, which was specifically entered into by you and your client, expressly says facts and circumstances of dismissed charges may be considered at sentencing.
That's right.
In that paragraph where you are talking about those higher sex assaults being dismissed. So the plea agreement specifically says, hey, okay, facts and circumstances of the dismissed charges may be considered at sentencing.
Yes.
Here you are arguing the exact opposite. How are we to apply? And I understand your reference to Sotoa Faiga and what that
– Sotoa Faiga, the way I read that rule, Justice Ginoza, is that it sets a limit on the court, not a personal right on the defendant.
So – you're saying essentially we asked for supplemental briefing on this issue,
yes.
Right? And that so it's a question of whether the holding and Sotoa Faiga can be waived, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
I appreciated that the court narrowed that issue down, and that's the issue that I'm really most interested in.
Sotoa Faiga was discussed the court considering penetration as an abuse of discretion, but it referred to Nunes, which basically said consideration of dismissed charges is unconstitutional.
Yes.
Without specifying what the constitutional provision was. I assume it was due process. So is it really a due process right or an abuse of discretion, a discretionary right that's being
I think here it's a due process right. Imagine the colloquies you would have to go through if a defendant is going to allow a judge. I don't think it sort of touches on subject matter jurisdiction that a defendant and a prosecutor could agree to expand a court's ability to sentence a defendant based on impact statements and conduct for which he wasn't convicted of. That expands subject matter jurisdiction. So I believe it's a due process right. I would think it would have to have Tachibana-style colloquies before somebody waived that right, and that certainly doesn't happen. The way I read Sotoafiga, and I believe the correct way, is that it sets more a limit by the court on it can't consider conduct logically excluded. Now, does that mean it can't consider circumstances? No, it doesn't, because I could foresee circumstances where, in this exact situation, a similar charge, sex assault 4, where somebody exposes their genitals to themselves, and then they immediately berate the person, they harass them, they send them threatening text messages after. That would demonstrate a lack of remorse, and so on and so forth.
So based on what you said, are you saying that there could be a waiver, but a colloquy would have to be conducted for the waiver to be valid? Is that the position you're taking?
No, I don't think that it's appropriate at all. When Sotoafiga...
Sotoafiga didn't deal with the waiver at all.
No.
And the court there didn't say you can't waive.
No, no.
It wasn't an issue at all.
No, but Justice Ginoza was asking me if they could, if that's a possibility, if we're taking the position that we can waive it. And I'm saying I don't believe it can, because I believe that it would be an effective agreement to enlarge the court's jurisdiction. The court
Can a defendant agree to waive immigration advisements?
Sure. That's a personal right that can be waived, but that doesn't require the judge to expand.
Does there have to be a knowing or intelligent or voluntary waiver, or is that a statutory right or a constitutional right?
What?
Are immigration advisements constitutional or statutory rights?
I believe probably both, I would think. Constitutional?
Okay. Because it's a part of the potential sentence.
Right. So, I mean, if the judge is going to say, look, if a court's going to say, I'll allow you to plead to a sex assault 4, but I'm going to consider all the dismissed charges, which are higher, and they include rape, when I make that decision.
Because you agreed to it.
Yeah. I think a colloquy, if this court decides that that's appropriate, then a colloquy would be required. So the defendant fully understands his due process rights.
Okay, so you can waive, but a colloquy is required to make the valid.
I don't know that the
valid waiver.
I don't know that the court should make that rule though, because the conduct logically excluded. When he pled to a sex assault 4, all that other conduct was logically excluded. I mean, it's not even a lesser included of a sex assault.
Do you have any case law where this court has ever ruled that a plea agreement that waives the dismissed charges, that it can now be considered that is improper?
No. However, there was, I noted a state versus Marino and Nunes and Sotoafiga. No, I'm not presently aware of that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Quiet, so where you and your client have expressly in the plea agreement agreed that facts and circumstances of dismissed charges may be considered at sentencing, and you're now saying, no, you can't do that. I assume that wasn't done knowingly by you at that time. Sotoafiga was issued the year before.
Right.
But my question leads to this. That's the circumstances here, clearly, right? You folks
right.
agreed
yes.
to that provision in the plea agreement, which you are now saying cannot be enforced. So my question is, what is the ultimate outcome then in this case? Should we go back to the plea agreement stage and undo the plea agreement?
No, Your Honor. like I say, in this
case. How is that fair to the state then? If that was an agreed upon term in the plea agreement that you are now saying is invalid, I'm trying to figure out where, if we agree with you, this case should be remanded to for what?
Well, in our case, we just attacked the factors under the deferral, and our main point was that we just wanted, you know, a fair analysis under the deferral statute that, you know, he was qualified, he's not likely to reoffend, and the ends of justice would.
But you were asking the state to be bound by that plea agreement, although you're now arguing that one of the terms, which I imagine was important to the state, that was favorable to the state, is now invalid. But you still want the benefit of that and to preclude the sentencing judge from considering the very things that you agreed could be considered.
In my opening brief, I didn't actually challenge that provision. When the supplemental briefing was requested, that's when I took the position more hardline, because I went back, read Sotoa Faiga, and the way I read it is not as a defendant held personal right that can be waived so much as a limiting instruction or what have you rule on the courts, what it can consider when there are dismissed charges and when there's a charge to which.
Is this a standard provision in plea agreements?
Yes.
On the Third Circuit?
Yes. Always in them. Always.
So the Third Circuit routinely says
yes.
Dismissed charges can be considered.
They've modified it now, I believe. They've modified it since to reflect restitution purposes, which I believe this court has ruled on that you can agree to pay more in restitution for other charges. But I would distinguish that by saying that's also a personal right that doesn't involve necessarily the court. He's agreeing to pay more in restitution, but in this situation, you would be involving the court in expanding its authority to sentence based on conduct that has been dismissed.
What about other waivers? Is that the only type of waivers in the Third Circuit? Are there, like, on the federal side, waivers of your right to appeal? Say the sentencing court strays from the guidelines, sentencing court makes procedural errors. Maybe the sentencing court doesn't even ask the person for to allocute. Are there waiver provisions on appeals that are now being embedded in plea agreements in the Third Circuit?
On appeal, not that I'm aware of. In the feds, I'm not sure. I would have to ask my partner, Andrew Kennedy, who would know about what's included in plea offers. I don't practice in a federal court. I'm sorry, I thought you had one more question in there.
You answered it.
Okay.
Counsel, on the initial plea agreement, was there a waiver of the dismissed charges?
No. No.
Only in the second agreement?
No. It was always in there. It was always that the dismissed charges can be considered a sentencing. Yes, it was always.
That was in the first agreement as well?
Yes, it was.
Thank you.
And it's always, it's always included in those. It's sort of a standard provision.
Am I correct in understanding that the court basically said, I'm not considering remorse, I'm not considering penetration, I'm not considering, you know, implicitly the waiver provision?
I don't know if it would go that far. He definitely said I'm not considering penetration. He said I'm not considering remorse, but that was immediately after he made a comment on I don't see remorse. And then he said I'm considering the impact on the victim, but the impact from the victim statement was sounded in rape, and that's when his decision to deny the deferral, because look, she's devastated, and she's saying I'm devastated because of rape, not because of exposure for which he was convicted, that's the problem that
I have. But going back to the first question I asked, is a lot of times the victims will get up there and, you know, they will say what happened to them. So you're basically bringing in a situation where it's the court would have to sort of splice and dice those comments versus a general comment about the impact on the victim. And isn't that what the court did here?
The court certainly did, but the victim was allowed to speak before the court imposes a sentence. And so I think the judge actually acknowledged it was a the first time she spoke, it was a powerful statement. And then, you know, I think.
So what was the court supposed to do, saying, okay, I understand, Madam Victim, what you said, and I'm going to deny the deferral because of the victim, the impact on you, because he exposed his genitals to you?
I don't even know that it needs to be so specific. You know.
Well, then, if it's not, doesn't have to be specific, it sort of cuts against your point, I would think.
I would think that under the 853, there are certain factors, and it's judge agreed that he qualified for the deferral. He agreed that, I believe he agreed that it was unlikely to reoffend. There was certainly no evidence that he was going to reoffend. Then it's the ends of justice and welfare, and he focused on the victim impact, which I don't necessarily think is wrong, but it was only on that.
If there was such focus on that, why didn't he impose the 50 hours of community service?
He did not impose the 50 hours of community service. That was the plea agreement, but I believe it was not imposed.
He didn't even impose the counseling, correct?
No.
So he ended up just imposing 1 year probation with standard conditions.
It was a good sentence.
On substance assessment as well, wasn't that part of the?
I believe he did have to get a substance abuse assessment, Justice Devins. Yes, and he completed everything, I believe.
Who wrote your supplemental brief?
Who wrote it? I wrote it.
Did you check all your case citations?
I did. Did I miss one?
Did you check the propositions for which you cited all those cases?
I believe so.
Personally? Yeah, did you do that personally?
I pull them up on Westlaw.
Thank you.
Is anything wrong on there, Justice Devins?
We asked the questions.
Okay. I would certainly like an opportunity to correct it if it was wrong. Thank you, Justice.
Reserving your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your
Honor. All right. Mr. Makalimpa?
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justice Frederick Makalimpa on behalf of the state.
Please.
This case is about preserving plea integrity, honoring victim allocution, as well as respecting judicial discretion under Hawaii Revised Statute 706604, 706606, as well as Hawaii Revised Statutes 853-1. This case is not Setua Faiga. There are notable differences between what happened in Mr. Gaeta's case as well as this case. In Setua Faiga, there was no waiver of consideration of dismissed charges. There was no explicit comment by the sentencing judge that the sentencing judge was denying the deferral based on penetration. The court did not punish silence of the defendant and did not rely on the dismissed charges without a waiver, and therefore acted within its statutory discretion to deny the deferral. In this case, during the supplemental, on the order granting cert, the court asked for supplemental briefing on two issues, whether or not dismissed charges can, whether or not that would be a waivable issue. And in the state's position, this is a waivable issue for the sentencing court to consider dismissed charges. Courts routinely allow the waiver of significant constitutional rights, such as the right to remain silent, the right to have a jury trial, the right to testify, as well as the right to have a trial itself. So the state's position is that allowing a sentencing judge to consider dismissed charges is something that could
be. But the no one's arguing with that. But the waiver has to be knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily. And there was no colloquy in this case. So where's the evidence that it was valid?
Respectfully, I would disagree. There was a sentencing, there was a change of plea. And in that change of plea, there was a colloquy conducted by the judge where the plea agreement was reviewed. And in the reviewing of the plea agreement, there was a provision that explicitly said it dismissed charges could be considered for sentencing purposes.
Right, but was it further explained that that's a right that normally you wouldn't have those charges dismissed considered following Satoy Faiga, that that would be off base, off limits?
That, I believe, was not explained.
However, shouldn't have that been explained so that the defendant fully understands what they're giving up?
I think that the circumstances of this case are different because, as noted in the record, there was an initial attempt to change the plea in which the nearly identical same plea form with the provision of dismissed charges could be considered was also explicitly explained. And at that time,
explicitly explained, what does that mean? You can tell somebody that it's going to be considered, but the significance of that, doesn't that have to be explained just like the other constitutional rights you rattled off?
I think what is different in this case is that the complainant had come to the first attempt at sentencing and said nearly exact identical victim allocution as during the current sentencing that's at issue. So in the state's position, it was knowing because the defendant had an opportunity to see exactly what the complainant was going to come in and say to the judge. So I would argue that there is a distinction.
That's one thing, but understanding the significance of what you're giving up, isn't that a colloquy requirement? Shouldn't it be a due process right that someone's giving up?
I would argue that even the immigration colloquy is embedded in the plea form, and the plea colloquies, or the provision about immigration consequences, is embedded in the colloquies with the change of plea. So I don't think that there would need to be a separate extensive colloquy because that the rights explained with the immigration consequences are still in the plea form. So I would think that the provisions explaining that...
So you're saying that's sufficient?
Yes, that's the state's
But the
position.
Judge went through a pretty detailed immigration colloquy here. The judge did never explained that this provision would mean that the court could consider penetration and all of the original charges, right? The judge never explained that. The judge just read this as a part of the plea agreement without explaining what impact that provision might have.
I think during the colloquy, the petitioner defendant still had the opportunity to ask the court, what does that mean? And in this case, there's nothing in the record that suggests that the Mr. Gaeta didn't understand the terms of the plea agreement.
All right. Let me change the subject in terms of the what Sato Faiga stands for.
Yes.
In Sato Faiga, it's stated it's not entirely clear from the record what weight the trial court gave to the alleged act of penetration. It is clear that it factored into the court's decision. Here, did penetration factor into the court's decision?
From my recollection of reading Satoa Faiga, what had occurred was during the sentencing, defendant Satoa Faiga had mentioned that, these were just text messages that happened between me and the minor, and the judge said, no,
right.
This was
here,
more than...
I understand.
Yes.
But here, the court... said I'm not considering penetration, I'm not considering remorse, I'm only considering the impact on the CW, and basically, basically was talking about, just kind of like look at her. Impact is what is based upon the impact upon the victim as stated during her statement to the court. That was the court's exact statement. I can't consider lack of remorse or penetration or any of the non-factual statements which I can't consider by the victim, but is based upon the impact upon the victim as stated during her statement to the court. The impact on her as stated during her statement to the court was entirely based on repeated allegations of rape. Isn't that correct?
I would agree with that. However, that is a factor that the courts are allowed to consider during the sentencing portion.
The court was allowed to consider the impact of dismiss charges, rape.
I would like to clarify that the court's allowed to look at the complainant and look at how they are at the time of giving their impact statement,
right,
and use that as a consideration. And I think that it's possible, and what did happen in this situation is that the court judges are considered to be able to disregard irrelevant evidence. And in this case, the court acknowledged that it was irrelevant to consider the impact of the penetration or alleged penetration and things like that, and had shifted its focus to looking at the demeanor of the complainant at the time of giving the sentencing allocution. So I think that the court was still acting, even with the waiver, if you consider, if this court says that the waiver is invalid, even not considering the waiver, I still would argue, the state would still argue that the judge was acting within his discretionary bounds to.
But the impact seemed to be based on, you know, CW is talking about rape, invasive testing, STD references, and the horrendous and disturbing act of violence he committed. That seems to relate to the other more serious charges rather than the exposure, doesn't it?
I would also again say that, again, even if the complainant is mentioning irrelevant information, our courts, the judges routinely are told and are assumed to disregard any kind of statements, just as if a complainant testifies at a trial.
I understand that, but that seemed to be the cause. The resulting impact was that was where it came from. That was the source. Isn't that what the statement seemed to be saying?
I would agree that that's where the complainant was coming from. However, I think that the sentencing judge in this situation was still upholding their duty to try and rely only on within the specific statutory factors set. And therefore, even if what was driving the complainant's demeanor at the time were these uncharged situations that she's describing, I would still argue that the sentencing court was still separating it.
Right, and you're basing that on the court statements on the record.
Correct.
Well, you know, had Mr. Quiet remained quiet and not objected, the court would have relied on that impermissible evidence. So it strikes me that that objection, unfortunately, sabotaged a possible right to appeal, and that it was almost simply just pretextual what the court said after that. What would be your response to that?
I would disagree because, again, judges are supposed to disregard, not only disregard.
Well, they're supposed to disregard it, but this judge wasn't until there was that objection. And if there wasn't an objection, he would have carried on. So does that mean that possibly strategically defense counsel should let the judge go on in an unlawful way?
Well, I would argue that judges also routinely correct themselves on the record as well when making decisions at trial. When an objection is raised, a judge can also turn to a different section of the law and for clarity of the record, point to the legal factor in either sustaining or denying an objection. So I think that in this case, it's a similar situation where once Mr. Quiet had raised the objection, the sentencing judge had acknowledged that there may have been an appealable issue and then sought a legal ground to base his decision on. So I would argue that that's had.
But then that legal ground, as Justice Devens was talking about later on, I'm basing this on the impact on the victim, and all the victim really testified to was her impact from sexual penetration, being drugged, possibly having STDs and all that.
I would argue that if the judge did not correct himself on the record and acknowledge Mr. Quiet's objection, this would lead up to further situations in the future where judges just withhold what their thinking is, and it would present situations where records in the future cannot be relied upon because a judge cannot. If I make an incorrect decision and don't correct myself, then I'm going to be appealed. I think that it is proper for the judge to correct themselves.
I understand. Can I switch back
yes.
to the appeal waiver? It seems to me, I thought I heard you say that essentially a defendant can waive away everything. And I'll ask you the similar question that I asked Mr. Quiet about appeal waivers. Let's say now the Third Circuit decides to embed in all their plea agreements appeal waivers where no matter what the court does error-wise at a sentencing hearing, that will be unappealable. Does that comply with due process?
I would argue that that type of waiver would not be that's something that cannot be waived because that's an issue of waiving subject matter jurisdiction.
No, we're waiving impermissible sentencing factors like not considering a dismissed charge.
The state's argument is that the sentencing factor is a personal right that the defendant can waive, and it's different from an issue of due process where waiver of saying you can't appeal this case anymore, that forecloses the person entering into the plea from seeking another court. And with that type of situation, again, that's like a person saying, okay, I waive my right to have the criminal court hear this criminal case. That's something I don't think that can be waived.
Well, it's waived all the time in the federal system with sentencing guidelines and procedural defects. So why couldn't that practice, under your theory, somehow find its way into our Hawaii state court system?
Those examples that you gave are procedural issues that can be waived versus saying that, okay, this court cannot hear something. So I would argue that the waiver that you gave, that you as an example, waives a person's ability to actually enter into the court itself. So that I would argue is impermissible versus something that would impact sentencing.
So it is the state's position that a defendant can waive all rights to fair process.
The state's position is that the right to trial is also part of the right to fair process, as the right to testify or the right to not testify.
The defendant could waive their right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusations against the defendant?
Defendants do regularly waive the right to having the charges read out loud in open court.
They could waive the right. They say, I don't know what I'm pleading to, but I plead no contest.
That would be a different situation because with a change of plea, there would be an information about what the allegation is. There would be a section where either a person pleads guilty to what they're doing or has the state read out loud what the factual basis is of what they're pleading to.
Mr. Quiet argues that the prohibition against a court considering dismissed charges in sentencing or in DAG-DANK motions is not just a personal right of the defendant, but something that pertains to judicial discretion, the role of judges, and what judges are supposed to be doing, the judicial system in general. How do you respond to that argument?
My response would be that in this situation, the deferral statute gives wide latitude for the judge to for discretion on whether they want to grant it or not grant it. And in this situation, the judge acted within his statutory authority to deny the deferral. And at the same time, this would not be a situation such as Kamanao, where the sentencing court was punishing a defendant for refusing to admit guilt. What had occurred in this situation is that the court did not even follow the plea agreement in imposing community service work, and simply had the defendant be placed on probation with no further jail and conduct any relevant treatment classes. So the state argues that what occurred in this situation was within the judge's discretion to do.
I just want to make sure your position then is, if this court were to determine that the right, I guess I'll refer to it as the Sato Afaiga right, is not waivable, or that an explicit colloquy is required to include that provision that was in the plea agreement, what should happen in this case? Does the state feel that the case should be remanded back to the point of the plea agreement?
That would be the state's position, because in this case, the petitioner received substantial benefits by entering into the plea agreement. As mentioned by counsel for the petitioner, multiple B-class felonies were reduced to a misdemeanor. And in exchange for that, the state had authorized the defendant to enter a plea into that misdemeanor. So the complainant had lost her opportunity to testify at trial in order to reach this agreement. And instead, the petitioner's testimony or proposed testimony was rerouted to just the sentencing judge. By entering into the plea agreement, the petitioner had prevented the complainant prevented a jury from hearing the complainant and possibly convicting the defendant on the original charges. So there was a substantial benefit that was received by entering this plea agreement.
My understanding was there was an initial plea agreement that fell apart, and then the one that was entered is the second one. Is the reasoning for, you know, what happened between the two, is anything relevant there to the particular Sato Afaiga provision?
Well, I was not at the prosecutor's office at the time of the change of plea or sentencing.
Okay.
So I'm just relying on my review of the transcripts. My understanding is that the only difference between the two was that the initial plea offer was that the state was not going to oppose the deferral, and the second offer, the state was going to oppose the deferral.
I see. Thank you.
You know, I think I just heard you say that, okay, well, send it back because of that faulty plea provision that we agreed there was a substantial benefit. But isn't that unfair to the defense? They didn't appeal that. They had nothing to do in their original appeal on the provision. They were just appealing the abuse of discretion on the dank denial. So why should it be sent back and everything starts from ground one?
If this court finds that there was an issue with the circumstances of the plea negotiation, plea agreement, then that would be a cause to send it back to before the entry of the change of plea.
But you'd also agree that in this case, whether it was down below before Judge Kim, whether it was on your initial briefing, nobody was even talking about the provision, right?
Correct.
Do you believe the count four, the exposure is a lesser included charge in count three, the attempted penetration?
No, I would disagree with that because there are different factors and elements into the charge. So I don't agree that count four would be, SA four would be included offense.
Let me ask you, when the court's considering the acceptance of a no contest plea, can the court consider a defendant's level of remorse at that stage?
I would argue that the Sotoa FICA does allow a court to consider lack of remorse. I believe that's what it explicitly wrote. I could be wrong.
And I'm talking about when the court's considering the initial acceptance of the no contest plea, whether or not remorse is a valid consideration. Maybe it relates to administration of justice under the penal procedure rule. What's your thoughts on that?
I think the case law has tied the remorse issue to whether or not a defendant is rehabilitatable or whether or not there's a likelihood of reoffense. So I think that is the way
that goes to consideration of the dang.
And also whether or not a defendant can be placed on probation. I think that would be a factor that could be considered as well. The nature and circumstances of the charge as well as the characteristics of the defendant. I can understand the situation with Kamanao where that became problematic because at the time the defendant Kamanao had been appealing his conviction and any kind of
scandal. I'm just talking about when the court's considering accepting a no contest plea. Before accepting it, yes. Can the court consider the defendant's level of remorse at that stage?
I do apologize, Justice. I haven't really thought about that issue very much.
That's fine. That's fair enough.
That was part of the request for supplemental briefing.
On the point too, the second one, I did respond to that in my supplemental brief. So I would argue that yes, it could be considered, and based on the case law presented,
when considering acceptance of the no contest plea.
Yes. I misunderstood the question from Justice.
If a court can consider lack of remorse in a no contest plea context, then what is the purpose of a no contest plea?
I understand the idea. My interpretation of the question from Justice Devins was before the acceptance of the plea. I think at the sentencing portion, I understand what Chief Justice is raising the question of, because no contest would imply that you're not saying anything and you're not admitting to guilt or denying guilt. You're just not contesting the charge of the case.
So if a court accepts a no contest plea, then the court can consider lack of remorse this isn't actually, the issue is whether or not the court can consider lack of remorse in ruling on a dank motion, right? That's really the issue here.
Yes.
In deciding whether or not to grant a dank, whether the court can consider lack of remorse.
So the state's position is that the court can consider lack of remorse when deciding whether or not to grant the deferral. My argument would be that although no contest would imply you're not saying anything for or against, that could be used as a basis for the factor in 853-1 about the likelihood of reoffense from
defendant. Court had already found that this defendant was not likely to reoffend, correct? So then what?
So the other factor aside from that is whether the unjust justice and the welfare of society require a defendant be suffer the punishment or the penalty of the conviction at the time. So I think even though the judge had made the finding that the defendant, Mr. Gaeta, was not likely to reoffend.
If a no contest plea, the big difference is admissibility in a civil proceeding, correct?
Yes.
And so if a court can can basically require a showing of remorse in the no contest context, then the defendant's statements would be potentially admissible at the would potentially be admissible in a civil context.
I understand where Chief Justice is going with this. I would argue that even though the court cannot compel the defendant at the time to admit guilt, they can. The state would still argue that they are able. The sentencing court is still able to consider lack of remorse.
How would the defendant show that? By saying, "I'm sorry this happened," or "I'm sorry about my actions"?
That I can see that saying "I'm sorry for what happened" would also tie into the potential civil liability of the issue.
It seems that if a no contest plea cannot be factored into a civil case, then by extension, what happens at the no contest plea, such as an admission or apology, would also not be allowed in the civil context. And I think practically that's actually what happens. Let me ask you this, though. No remorse seems to be a feature that is actually inherent in no contest pleas, because you're not admitting to a factual basis. So if no remorse is somewhat inherent in the plea itself, then why should remorse even be considered on a no contest plea? And it strikes me that remorse really only would apply when there's a guilty plea, because a dismissed charge, an acquitted charge, even a guilty conviction, where the person's going to appeal, that's when the Kamanao three-step process comes in. So it seems like it's very limited circumstances in which remorse can actually be considered, and that would really just be on a guilty plea. So getting back to what I just asked, I mean, isn't no remorse an inherent feature of a no contest plea?
I would argue that someone can choose not to dispute the charges and still be remorseful for the situation that occurred.
Okay, and I think that probably happens a lot. People will plead no contest. Look, we all know that no contest pleas are an inducement to the defense, because oftentimes defendants just don't want to admit it. And the system would actually not work, particularly the district court level, if we didn't really allow no contest pleas. But I guess that's a different situation when somebody pleads no contest and is expressing remorse, and that being a factor to sort of help the person, versus not expressing remorse and hurting the defendant. You see the distinction?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I think, again, it is a situation where it's just difficult because of the nature of how the criminal justice cases work and trying to find resolutions to charges. But the state's argument, I would maintain, is that just based on what's presented in the case law so far, the courts are still permitted to consider lack of remorse during the no contest plea.
Well, in a no contest situation, the defendant is still receiving some sort of sentence, correct?
Yes.
All right, and 706-606 still applies?
Yes.
Okay, is there any carve-out for a no contest that characteristics of the defendant is not considered when it's a no contest circumstance?
My understanding is no.
Thank you.
I think I've gone over the time limit, so...
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal, Mr. Quiet.
I would waive rebuttal unless any justices have any follow-up questions for me. I'm happy to answer.
Any questions from the court?
Well, yeah, since we're talking about the remorse, let's say on a no contest plea, we have an emotional victim impact statement, much like this particular case, and the defendant's just sitting there with a goofy look on his or her face, sort of disrespectful. All right, defendant, you have the right to allocution. Nah. I mean, what if the defendant really just demonstrates indifference, defiance? Doesn't that suggest what Justice Devens was just saying, that, hey, I have to look at the history and characteristics of this defendant. That's a clear 706-606 factor. And we have this person who, yeah, call it no remorse, call it defiance, call it whatever you want, but I can't consider that?
I think it's limited to, you cannot consider the absence or silence as lack of remorse. If he were to say something and it was flippant, or as I had mentioned earlier, if immediately after the offense he taunted her or sent her harassing messages, I think judges should consider lack of remorse if that were the case here. But we're talking about a lack of remorse for the offense for which he was convicted, not for an offense that's been dismissed. And that's the distinction that I want to draw, especially with the impact when the judge is making any decision based on an impact that flows from a rape when he wasn't convicted of a rape. That's where I have the due process objection. That's all I would say. Thank you.
You know, there are studies that seem to show that judges have a lot of differences of opinion as to what constitutes remorse. In terms of the factual situation that was just presented, what about if the defendant is neurodivergent or has some issues that might appear to some judge as being a lack of remorse, but maybe it's some sort of underlying
In that issue. Case, I would hope for a PSI. I didn't have a PSI in this case because there was a deal, essentially.
Right. I noticed there was no PSI.
Right. But a PSI, it's useful for judges. And, I've learned that through experience, that judges really like those PSIs. And they're very useful later on down the line. For example, if you have revocations and stuff. And I think certainly it would have been useful here and in favor of my client, I believe.
All right. Thank you very much.
If I may,
yes.
Chief Justice, your supplemental brief, it was docket 9 on page 2. You cite this case, State versus Adams, I think it's 76-08-408, for the proposition that the parties may not stipulate to a sentence or sentencing rationale that exceeds what the law allows. Did Adams really stand for that proposition?
That could be a paraphrase, and it could be incorrect. I would have to rebrief that. If that is incorrect, I would not stand by that, Your Honor.
Do you remember what Adams...
I don't off the top of my head. I know Mr. Maka-Penlock cited it, though, as well.
It was a plea agreement where the state agreed not to chime in on the sentencing, and the court found there was a breach of that material term of the plea agreement.
Okay.
Does that refresh your memory?
Yes.
Did that have anything to do with the statement you represented to this court that I just read?
Did what have anything?
Did that case stand for what I just read?
No.
Be careful what you submit to the court.
Understood, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing it out.
All right. This court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.
Ku iluna, please rise.
Ua ho o ku ia mai ne kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki ike hanahano o komaku ana o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.